Well, ladies and gentlemen, Canada's Minister of Finance, the Honourable James Michael Flaherty, is joining us from a secure location in Ottawa.
There is no secure
It is actually the Bell Video Conferencing Centre at their headquarters on Elgin Street in Ottawa. And we thank Bell, and particularly Lynn Mayhew and her colleagues, for facilitating this on rather short notice. For the reasons that we all know, Minister Flaherty couldn't join us in person today, and his son Galen is particularly unhappy about that because it means no cash from Dad for the weekend. We're going to ask Heather Monroe-Bloom to introduce the minister. We'll have brief opening remarks, and then we'll have a conversation and a brief Q&A.
Merci beaucoup, Ian, et re-bonjour, chers collègues, étudiants, invités distingués. This year, we turn outward to one of the most enduring and essential facets of the Canadian condition, our relationship as a country and as a people with the United States of America. Gathered today at McGill University, an extraordinary combination of Canadians and Americans to exchange with one another. On behalf of the whole McGill community and all of us gathered, I wish to welcome to McGill University via our new technology the Minister of Finance of Canada, the Honourable James M. Flaherty. I've had the enormous pleasure and honour of knowing Mr. Flaherty over many years, beginning back when Minister Flaherty was Minister of Finance in Ontario and I was also resident in Ontario. Minister Flaherty's had a most distinguished political career, currently a second-term Member of Parliament for Whitby, Oshawa in Ontario. He was first elected on January 2006. Since his election to a federal seat, he has served as Canada's Minister of Finance and Minister responsible for the Greater Toronto Area. He is a Governor of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and as the Minister of Finance, he is an ex officio member of all Cabinet committees. Minister Flaherty was recently awarded Euromoney Magazine's Finance Minister of the Year Award, most deserved, for his work in enhancing Canada's reputation for sound fiscal policy while taking full account of social justice and overseeing a strong regulatory regime that has kept the financial sector out of chaos here in Canada. In 2010, Minister Flaherty was chair of the G7 Finance Ministers and chair of the annual Commonwealth Finance Ministers meeting. Previously, for more than 10 years, he served as the member of the Provincial Parliament for Whitby Ajax. He served as Deputy Premier and Minister of Finance, Attorney General and Minister of Labour for the Government of Ontario. Prior to his career in politics, Minister Flaherty was called to the bar in Ontario with honours and practiced law with Flaherty Dow Elliott for more than 20 years, a firm of which he was founding member and which specialises in motor vehicle accident and personal injury litigation. Born in Lachine, Quebec, Minister Flaherty attended Bishop Whelan High School and Loyola High School in Montreal. He is also a hockey player and a hockey fan. He's married to Christine Elliott, who serves as a member of the Provincial Parliament for Whitby, Oshawa, the first time in Canadian history that a husband and wife have simultaneously represented the same electoral district at two different levels of government. Minister Flaherty has a Bachelor of Arts cum laude degree from Princeton University, as well as a Bachelor of Laws degree from Osgoode Hall Law School at York University. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Minister Flaherty is the proud father of three boys, triplets, one of whom, Galen, is currently a McGill student. Let me say, as I now introduce Minister Flaherty on behalf of those of us in the university community, how grateful we are as well for his great contributions to the innovation agenda for Canada, the investment in the Canada Excellence Research Chairs, the Vanier Fellows, and a suite of programs that have really positioned Canada to compete with the best in the world in the intellectual research and scholarly realms. Minister Flaherty, over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Madam President Heather. I appreciate that kind introduction. You read it just like we wrote it, and I always appreciate that. I get introduced to various things. I'm glad that Galen is enjoying his time at McGill. I thank you all for being there and understanding that this has been an unusual week in Ottawa. It is a pleasure to be with you at the end of such a quiet week here on the Hill. Je suis heureux d'être avec vous à la fin d'une semaine aussi tranquille. I had hoped to be there, of course, with you at McGill in person this morning, but as you know, certain developments have overtaken us this week at the Hill. I want to begin by saluting McGill University and the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada for its foresight in organizing this timely and important conference. In doing so, your university is again acting in its finest traditions that have made it one of Canada's leading educational institutions. And I particularly thank Neurel Blum for her leadership. She is one of our great Canadian university presidents and certainly a force on the international scene on behalf of Canadian universities and secondary education and research overall. 2 years ago, I gave a speech at this very conference that focused on public policy in crisis, an accusation that I did not take personally. The events of those times precipitated the creation of Canada's Economic Action Plan, which is our response to the deepest worldwide recession since the 1930s. Massive in scale and executed with historic speed, the plan is on track to deliver more than $60 billion in stimulus. It helped promote economic stability for Canadians during the worst of the global recession and included key investments that will contribute to Canada's long-term economic prosperity. Without question, it has underpinned a solid and enviable economic recovery here in Canada. Earlier this week, I tabled the next phase of Canada's Economic Action Plan, a low-tax plan for jobs and growth. This is our budget, 2011. It builds on the success of the original Economic Action Plan. With the next phase of Canada's Economic Action Plan, our government is focusing on completing our economic recovery. The next phase of the plan will focus on elements crucial to long-term economic success, supporting job creation to help Canadian businesses and entrepreneurs, supporting families and communities to ensure all Canadians enjoy a high standard of living. Importantly, and as a priority, investing in innovation, education, and training, and an important track, preserving Canada's fiscal advantage by returning to balanced budgets, that is, in the medium term. I've highlighted many of the measures contained in the next phase of the action plan in recent days. We'll speak more about that in conversation with Ian in a moment, I'm sure, but I want to discuss our investments in that important priority of innovation, education, and training for a moment, which puts me in mind of one of McGill's greatest historical figures, the renowned neurosurgeon Wilder Penfield, and a fitting reference for this conference. He was once considered the greatest living Canadian. Of course, he was born in Spokane, Washington. He founded McGill's world-famous Montreal Neurological Institute with the financial help of American philanthropist David Rockefeller. And his contributions, honed in both our nations, benefited the entire world, just as our two countries continue to do, whether it's in imposing G20 boardrooms or modest Afghan villages. To say that the global economy depends increasingly on knowledge and innovation is to state the obvious. But it explains why investing in research and development, education and training are an essential part of our Economic Action Plan. It includes nearly $5 billion in science and technology initiatives, including a $2 billion knowledge infrastructure program, which funded more than 500 maintenance, repair, construction projects at universities and colleges across Canada. The next phase of the plan strengthens Canada's research advantage by providing significant new resources to strengthen Canada's global research leadership, support advancements in priority areas such as health research, genomics, and environmental technologies, and encourage the commercialization of research. We are doing so by further boosting the funds available to the federal granting councils, investing further funds in the Canada Excellence Research Chairs Program, proposing an additional $65 million for Genome Canada, providing additional funds to Quebec's National Optics Institute. And in an initiative Wilder Penfield, I think, would no doubt have approved, this week we announced a contribution of up to $100 million to support the launch of Canada Brain Research Fund, which will support the very best Canadian neuroscience and accelerate discoveries to improve the health and quality of life for Canadians suffering from brain disorders. I realize my time is limited, so I will conclude here. I thank McGill. I thank Heather once again for the input every year, the advice I get every year in the preparation of Canada's budgets. This is our sixth budget. The first five have passed. It looks like this one actually won't come to a vote. There's a non-confidence motion in a couple of hours in the House of Commons, so it looks like we will have an election, but I'm confident the opportunity for a vote on the budget will come a little bit down the road. It'll be somewhat delayed. So thank you, Ian, and I welcome our conversation and questions.
Thank you, Minister. So, Minister, how's your week been so far?
It just keeps getting more exciting every day. There's a lot of buzz on the Hill today, but it's quite clear what's going to happen.
Is this a budget to run on?
Oh, absolutely. I'm looking forward to the opportunity to present the budget to the ultimate deciders in Canada, who are the voters across the country. I think it's balanced in two ways. One is, of course, moving to balance the budget, which is very important given the debt and deficit issues around the world, including in our great neighbor in the United States. So that's important, and it's a sound fiscal track, and the economists and the private sector support us, and I listen to them carefully about risk adjustments and so on. We have a substantial risk factor built into our economic projections on the revenue side, but that's also balanced, I think, in the sense of making sure that we don't imperil our own economic recovery in Canada. It is fragile. We all know about the events around the world, the most recent tragic events in Japan, the instability that arises out of some of the European banking and sovereign debt situations, the continuing weakness in the U.S. market, of course, is a concern for Canadian exports. So we all know that we have to continue to protect job creation in Canada. At the same time, look farther down the road and look at innovation training, what I just spoke about at the outset.
It seems like Mr. Layton kicked the tires of the car, but he didn't take the car out for a spin.
Well, there's a lot of tire kicking going on, I tell you. We started working on this budget last December, and I wanted to do it, of course, before the end of the fiscal year, which is next week, the end of March. And the Prime Minister met with Mr. Layton. I met with the finance critic. I had lots of correspondence and discussions with other members of the New Democratic Party. Of course, I met with the other opposition parties also. But the Bloc and the Liberals decided very early on that it didn't matter what was in the budget. They were going to vote against it. So there wasn't much point in having continuing discussions with them, nor did they ask to have continuing discussions because they made up their minds. But it was important to have continuing discussions with the NDP, which I did, and I had continuing discussions with some union representatives who are close to the NDP. I think that's the reasons why the response of some of the unions following the budget was favorable to the budget, because we did take some steps that the NDP and the unions wanted in the budget, so there was some consideration. We want a minority parliament to work. After all, we've done five budgets that have passed. That's a record in Canadian history in a minority parliament, and we wanted the sixth one to pass as well. We already have a fixed election date in October next year, so now we're going to go, I guess, have an election, spend $300 or $400 million on an election in the next several weeks.
One of the things that got my attention in the budget, Mr. Flaherty, was the $500 tax credit for children's cultural programs. I have a 21-month-old daughter at home, and we're calling that Zara's music class. What else in here would you like to run on among the baubles you put in this budget? Because there's everything from funding for volunteer firemen to funding for home caregivers to this is known in the trade as a pretty smart budget.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, we're conscious of the fact that we are a minority government, and we have to listen broadly, which we did in consultations across the country. I don't think the Children's Arts Tax Credit will help much with Galen, who's a football player and a rugby player. He's already had the benefit growing up of the Children's Fitness Tax Credit before he got a bit older. But it's an important credit, and it balances things out. And we heard that in Quebec, certainly. We heard it across the country that lots of kids participate in different kinds of activities, all of which are part of growing up and becoming a more fulsome human being, and this is something that that government can foster and encourage. And some families do struggle with expenses like that. They are not essential expenses, so it's a useful thing to have a tax credit above that. On the job side, it's important that what we did on the EI side. I mean, we are encouraging small businesses. There are more than 500,000 of them in Canada. To hire more people in the next year. And we did create an EI credit for that, specifically for those small businesses in Canada, because we know they are the job generators in the country. We also know that some of our industries, like forestry, have gone through a very difficult time. A lot of older workers in those industries have only had one job most of their lives, but they're not in a position to retire yet, but they are older. So we're continuing the targeted benefits that we have with respect to retraining older workers. We're also continuing work share, which is very important. It's preserved a lot of jobs in the country in small, medium, and large businesses by the government picking up one day a week, rather than having people lose their jobs and go on to unemployment insurance and social assistance after that. So the job creation parts of this are very important. As I said earlier, to try to get to that balance where we continue to have economic growth, we don't slide backwards. It's not dramatic economic growth. It is moderate economic growth, 2.9% or so real GDP. But if we can keep it going, and we hope the American recovery will start to show some substantial recovery as well. There are some good signs in the U.S. economy that will be in good shape over the course of the medium term.
There is no HST harmonization deal in this budget, but you're apparently fairly close with Quebec on that. What are the chances of a breakthrough in the next 37 days?
Not likely. Premier Charest, in fact, commented on that after the budget this week, indicating that there are some difficult issues that still need to be resolved, which is so. When we had our negotiations in the past couple of years with the provinces of British Columbia and Ontario, first of all with Ontario, they were very detailed negotiations and they took a long time. We then used the Ontario agreement as a model for our discussions with the province of British Columbia. As a result, those discussions were shorter. But we haven't yet got to a position with the government of Quebec where we're ad idem on a couple of very important issues. We're awaiting a technical paper from the government of Quebec about some of the technical issues, which are technical, but they're also very important because this is a tax agreement, and the I's have to be dotted and the T's have to be crossed before we can sign. So the government of Quebec certainly understands that because of the election, the government cannot continue to have day-to-day negotiations. It's not parliamentary tradition to do that, so we'll have to wait till after the election to try to arrive at a finalization of the agreement with the government of Quebec.
Let me take you through some Canada-U.S. comparatives on fiscal frameworks. The Canadian deficit is now 2.5% of GDP, and when we get to balance in 2015, our federal debt will be 30% of GDP. The current American deficit of 11% is $1.6 trillion, more than the size of the Canadian economy. And the U.S. federal debt of $14.3 trillion will cross 100% in 2012, and they have to raise the debt ceiling. Do you worry about that on behalf of our American friends? And have you talked with Secretary of the Treasury, Tim Geithner, about that?
Well, certainly, Secretary Geithner, Tim and I talk often about many things. In fact, I will see him this evening in Calgary. We are hosting, Canada's hosting the Council of the Finance Ministers of the Americas and the Caribbean tonight and tomorrow in Calgary. We've met before in Mexico and Peru and in Chile, and this year Canada is hosting. Tim is coming, and the finance, well, more than 30, about 35 or so finance ministers from all of the Americas and the Caribbean. I'm sure this is going to be one of the subjects that we talk about, both formally and informally, not only with respect to the United States, but also with respect to some other countries that are struggling with debt and deficit problems, particularly some of the Caribbean countries that rely a lot on tourism. But yes, Secretary Geithner and I talk about this. I've also talked with the majority leader in the House of Representatives about this, and before that, with Mr. Frank, he and I used to meet in Washington and talk about these same issues. It's important that the U.S. arrive at a plan. that will create confidence in their economy. It's not for me to tell any other country what to do in terms of their finances. But we all know from what we've seen in other countries in the world that at some point markets will have an approach where they see vulnerability in sovereign debt. And so it's important to have a plan to get to balance in the medium term. Now, I recognize it's very difficult in the American political context to accomplish a plan like that. President Obama has put forward a plan. I've spoken to his economic advisor about that plan. They view that as a part of the conversation. It gets the conversation going with the Congress about how to arrive at a reasonable plan that will create consumer confidence, business confidence in the United States and confidence around the world. It's not that easy in our system either, as we're learning with this budget this week. But we can go have an election, and I'm hopeful that with a good result in the election, we can bring our same budget back. As I've said, the main thing to me in this budget is is not tax credits. It's the fiscal track. And the fact that we can show every year that we will reduce our deficit by at least 25%, and we can balance our budget in 2015-16, and perhaps even the year before that, where we're very close to balance. This was about the United States, this is the worry that the Prime Minister and I had back in 2006 when we were first elected and first became the government in Canada. When we looked at what are the dangers to the Canadian economy around the world, our primary concern was the degree of spending, of deficits and accumulating public debt in the United States. So we have to, it's not just the United States, of course, there are challenges in Europe as well, and the recent tragic events in Japan. And who knows what else will come down the road. So our job here in Canada is to get Canada into the best position we can so that we can resist whatever the next crisis is, as we were able to with the Great Recession a couple of years ago.
When you look inside the employment numbers in the two countries, what do you see? We have an employment rate of 61.8, and the U.S. employment level is 58.3%. That's historic that we're 3.5 points higher than the U.S., and the unemployment side is all the jobs that we lost in the Great Recession have been recovered, and then some, 480,000 new jobs since July of 2009, while in the U.S., 7 million jobs have been lost that aren't coming back, and unemployment's still around 9%. The Americans being our best friends and largest trading partners, do you worry about the pace of their recovery a little bit?
I do. As I said a moment ago, Ian, there are some encouraging signs in the U.S. economy with respect to consumer confidence, with respect to investment by business in machinery and equipment, with respect to exports. So it's not all doom and gloom. There's a lot of doom and gloom about the housing sector, which is a major part of the American economy, as it is in our economy. The unemployment situation, it looks relatively good in Canada compared to the United States. We're all concerned about structural unemployment, and we watch that and try to analyze that. I know that Ben Bernanke's concerned about this, and Tim Geithner, about dealing with some of the unemployment that arises out of fundamental change in sectors of the economy. And this is why in Canada we're emphasizing retraining programs and skills training, especially for workers who are either young workers who are not adequately skilled to fit into the jobs that are being created, and older workers who are perhaps mid-career who do need to retrain in order to fit into some of the jobs that are being created in the knowledge-based economy.
Can you take us back to the weekend of October 10th, 2008, 4 days before the Canadian election, when you went to Washington at the invitation of the Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson, with other G7 and I think G20 ministers. The world seemed to be like a moment when time stood still. It wasn't clear that the stock market was going to open the following week. What was that like in that room?
It was very tense. It's the most tense international meeting I've ever participated in before or after. And I've now served longer than any of the other G7 ministers of finance, despite the fact that we have a minority government. That was an interesting time. I hope it doesn't happen during this general election in Canada. We were in a general election in October 2008. The Prime Minister and I were talking regularly during the election campaign campaigning during the day and then talking at night on the phone about world events and the concerns that we had about the Canadian economy. As you know, banks were failing in the United States, United Kingdom. German regional banks were failing. I was having lots of discussions with the CEOs of our financial institutions about how they were doing, talking a lot to our regulators about what they were seeing in the Canadian markets, talking to the governor of the Bank of Canada, of course. All of these things were taking place in the middle of an election campaign, and people forget very quickly how much uncertainty there was at the time. No one knew where the bottom was. This was a new experience in this generation, and in fact for the last generation. It's a new experience since the 1930s. In any event, in that week leading up to Friday, October 10th, we were in the last week of our election campaign in Canada. The Prime Minister agreed with me that we needed to take some steps to protect our financial institutions from what was going on abroad. One of the things that had happened is Ireland started the ball rolling by having the government of Ireland guaranteeing the debt of their banks. And that started some other countries taking similar steps. So what we did is we announced that we would guarantee the wholesale debt of our banks. We also announced on the Friday morning, which was October 10th, that we would purchase the insured mortgages. We insure them anyway in the government of Canada, the insured mortgages held by our banks and other financial institutions. And that created liquidity in the system and some assurance that there would be sufficient liquidity. I went to Washington after that on Friday morning. We met in the cash room of the Treasury at 1 o'clock. This is not an unusual meeting. It's the fall meeting of the G7 central bank governors and finance ministers. We always meet in the same place. But it was very tense. And, you know, Hank Paulson came in and he started the meeting by saying, we're all in a lot of trouble. The markets may not open on Monday. The markets may not open in the United States. May not open in Europe. What are we going to do? The meeting started with some acrimony, I must say. The Europeans were fairly aggressive vis-a-vis the United States. Certainly, in that context, the finance minister sitting around, there usually is sort of guarded words, but there was some aggression there, handed out a graph showing what had happened to spreads since Lehman Brothers had failed, some blame attributed to the U.S. government for not saving Lehman Brothers. You know, I did speak up on that, actually, because, as I just said a moment ago, this wasn't solely an issue that arose in the United States. In fact, this is an issue that we had talked about before. We had talked about it at a previous meeting in Australia in July about where would the credit crisis come from. We all knew there was too much money sloshing around, too much liquidity in the world. Now, the crisis arose initially in the United States, but it was very clear that some of the European banks were over-leveraged, and that was clear in the United Kingdom as well. So after some discourse, things sort of calmed down, and we all agreed we would tear up the communique. Now, the communiques are prepared by our officials in advance. They're very dense, long documents that hardly anybody ever reads. So we tore that up, and we came up with a 5-point plan, which is very important. And we met with President Bush the next morning in the Roosevelt Room of the White House. He agreed with it, went out to the Rose Garden, said this is the right thing to do. We then met with the IMF. We met with the finance ministers of the Americas, with whom we're meeting again this weekend in Calgary, got their endorsement of what we were doing. And then later in the evening, we had a meeting of the G20, which President Bush attended, and the G20 endorsed the agreement. That's a long story, I know, but that was a very important day, or 2 days, really, October 10th and 11th, 2008.
Let me ask you about the auto industry and the bailout of 2009, because I know you were very much involved with that, and you come, in fact, from Oshawa, Whitby, Oshawa, which is the home of General Motors in Canada, at least of their main production. We now own 12% of General Motors, and the U.S. has about a 60% position, I think. Does that turn out to have been the right thing to do? Is there any doubt in your mind that saved the auto industry in Canada?
No, there's no doubt in my mind about that. It's also a really good example, Ian, of the value of our close relationship with the U.S. government, in my case at that time with Hank Paulson, and then with Tim Geithner, that we were able to work together very closely in order to make sure that we both were on the same track. We ultimately both governments decided to make the same decision that we would lend the necessary money and invest in General Motors and in Chrysler. This had to be coordinated. There had to be a plan about how we would exit over time. And again, when the time came for the IPO by General Motors, again, we met and discussed it. I was able to negotiate with Tim Geithner that we would take the same approach. We did not end up taking an identical approach, by the way. We actually sold less of our interest than the United States government did initially with General Motors. But we are agreed that we will exit, just as the U.S. government will exit from ownership of General Motors over a period of time. We don't want to disrupt markets, of course. But this very good relationship, this ability to just pick up the phone and talk about it is vital in these types of crisis situations, which certainly the auto issue was in late 2008.
Can I suggest to you that maybe the rescue of GM and Chrysler was in 2009, May of 2009, was where President Obama and Prime Minister Harper really solidified their relationship as partners, because these were the two guys who closed the deal.
That's right, and it wasn't easy to do. Fortunately, President Obama chose as his first foreign trip to come to Canada, which he did shortly after his inauguration. It was a great event on Parliament Hill when he spent a day here. Larry Summers came with him, and I met with Larry Summers, talked about the fiscal situation, of course, in the United States, about the auto sector, and so on. That degree of direct cooperation is very important to accomplish the goal. It wasn't that easy in the Canadian context either, because you're right, my riding is Whitby Oshawa, and obviously General Motors is a very important player there. But in many parts of Canada, like where I'm going to be this afternoon in Alberta, or this evening, the manufacturing sector, certainly the auto sector, is not an important part of the economy. It's always a challenge, and I'm sure it's a challenge to American legislators, as it is for us in Canada, to try to make sure that we have balance in the country and that other regions of the country understand the importance of success of various sectors, even though those sectors are concentrated in one part of the country rather than another.
Okay, Minister, stay with us. We're going to take some questions from the Internet only in this session to give the people outside the room a chance at the Minister. There'll be no questions from the microphones in the room. Adam, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Where are you?
Right here.
Oh, there you go. Okay, have you got some questions from out there in cyberspace?
We do.
For the Minister.
We do. We have a question from Laura in Ottawa, who sort of relates things back to what we heard yesterday. She says, yesterday at the conference, former Prime Minister Mulroney and former Secretary of State Baker decried what seems to be a lack of support right now for free trade. And she wonders, how do you see the immediate future of free trade between our two countries and in the Western Hemisphere more generally?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the challenge we all have is the lack of dynamism, to put it mildly, in the Doha round of negotiations. And I've been at these G20 meetings with the leaders and so on, where everyone around the table says, well, we really got to get going on Doha, and of course it doesn't happen after that. And some of the people that speak the loudest about advocating progress in Doha are the most intransigent when it actually comes to negotiations around the table. It's important that we promote even more free trade with the United States. President Obama, President Harper get along very well. At their most recent meeting in the White House, they agreed on having senior officials meet and work on de-thickening the border between Canada and the United States, and they've already made some progress on that. That'll be an important test, I think, of the ability of both governments to actually make progress on the ground in terms of border security. We're also making progress on perimeter security for North America, which makes a lot of sense, of course, if one analyzes the situation. In terms of free trade itself, we're making other agreements with Panama, with Peru, with other countries, many of whom I'll see this evening in Calgary. We're going ahead with those negotiations. Very importantly for Canada, we're making rapid progress in our negotiations with India and with the European Union. Both of those negotiations are ahead of schedule, which is very encouraging.
Next one, Adam.
Okay. We have a question from Henry in Toronto, who asks, do any parts of your proposed budget relate specifically to issues that Canada addresses jointly with the United States? And if so, how so?
Well, the economic issues we share, of course, with the United States, and with the other G7 and G20 countries. We want to make sure that we have debts and deficits that are controllable. In fact, at the G20 summit in Toronto last June, Prime Minister Harper led the discussion, which resulted in certain targets being agreed to by Canada, the United States, and the other 18 countries around the table with respect to debts and deficits. So this is very important for the world overall. With respect to other issues, we've already built into our budget, our military spending, our defense spending, our foreign aid spending over the course of the next 4 or 5 years. That's already built into the fiscal plan. A lot of that, of course, relates to security of North America, which is a common interest of Canada and the United States.
What's your next one, Adam?
Jennifer in Ottawa asks the minister, many people see the twin goals of economic advancement and environmental sustainability as mutually exclusive goals, especially regarding things like oil sands development in Alberta. Is this necessarily so?
It's a good question. No, it is not so. In fact, we don't agree with that. We think that sound environmental policy is sound economic policy. That's why, for example, in this budget and the preceding two budgets, I've taken away some of the tax benefits that were available to oil sands production. By the way, the reaction in the oil community has been fairly positive to that. The development is very strong in Western Canada, not only in Alberta, but also in Saskatchewan. We made a commitment in the G20, all of us did around the table, that we would reduce our tax incentives in that area. And Canada, as usual, is keeping its commitments, quite frankly, in the G20 context. I think that's very important. We can develop the oil sands in an environmentally friendly way. This is very important, by the way, in our relationship with the United States. I've spent a lot of time, as have others, meeting with the members of the Senate and the U.S. Congress to talk with them about the oil sands. We've invited many of them to visit the oil sands. Many of them have, Senator Graham and others, have taken the opportunity to do that. It helps them understand what is actually happening there, how it can be environmentally friendly. It also emphasizes, in an uncertain world, the stability of Canada, the fact that we're a democracy, that we have the rule of law, that we believe in freedom, that we are the closest neighbor the United States has in terms of a major oil resource country, that we provide more oil to the United States every day than anyone else does. So it's important in two ways with respect to the oil sands. One, that we decrease the incentives, which we're doing in line with our G20 commitments, but also that we try to help our neighbors get as familiar as possible with the reliability and the environmental sustainability of oil sands development.
I have one question from the room that might be better directed at Ben Bernanke than you, Minister Flaherty. It concerns U.S. Monetary policy and quantitative easing. And the question is, what are the prospects for U.S. Treasuries after QE2 expires at the end of June?
You know I'm not going to go there. I don't even comment on monetary policy.
I didn't think so.
I'll leave that to Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of Canada. No, I'm not going there. I can say, I mean, our government has supported quantitative easing in the short term. We are worried about the effects down the road, and it is a short-term strategy. Just as our agreement last week to intervene with respect to the yen is a short-term measure to help ensure that there is stability and that we combat disorder in the trading of the yen.
Final question from Adam and the Internet.
Minister, this is a question from David in Montreal, and he would like to know, in your time as a cabinet minister, you have worked with two very different American governments. In your view, do the commonalities between our two countries transcend the differences?
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up in Montreal in the 1960s, Went to Loyola High School in Montreal. Played hockey. We were close to the U.S. We used to go down to Boston College High School and play hockey tournaments and other sports, which we exchanged, you know, with the U.S. I was fortunate to go to Princeton in the U.S. I've never been part of the development that happened for a time in Canada, the sort of anti-American feeling that developed among some for a while. I was never part of that. I remember in the meeting we had with President Bush that I referred to previously back in October 2010, when he came into the Roosevelt Room, I was actually standing to the door, and the door bumped into me, and he said, "Oh, you're having an election up there and so on in Canada." He asked me, first thing he said to me was, "Are you going to win?" And I said, "Well, we'll see on Tuesday." And then later on he said to me, "Are they still mad at me up there in Canada?" And I said, "Not so much." And, you know, I think that we've had ebbs and flows in our relationship, but Canadians understand the value of the relationship, the direct contact, how much we have in common, how much movement there is of people and services between, and products, of course, between our two countries, the great migrations that have happened by immigrants into Canada than into the United States, and vice versa. We share a great deal in our histories, and I think it's important that we foster that, that we make sure that we maintain that kind of close relationship with the United States. It doesn't mean we'll always agree, but certainly, to answer your question, the commonalities far outweigh the differences.
And I should point out, Jim, that our great Loyola High School hockey teams never lost to Boston College High, ever, in the 1960s, and that you were a star on the 1965 City Championship senior team that was undefeated. In those days, Jim wore number 16 because his hero was the pocket rocket, Henri Richard. And he took that number with him to Princeton, too. And while it's a virtual presentation, Galen Flaherty has a thank you to make to his dad and a presentation to Canada's Finance Minister, Jim Flaherty. Stay with us, Jim.
On behalf of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, I'd like to thank Minister Flaherty for taking the time to speak to us today, and I'm sure it's a very busy day for him. I know I always enjoy hearing him speak, and I found his comments on investing in the future of Canadians particularly of interest. And as a small show of appreciation, I'd like to present a McGill University hockey jersey with the number 16 and Flaherty on the back.
There you go.
I'll be happy to keep it warm for you, and thank you very much, Mr. Flaherty.
Thanks, Galen. You've called me many things. Thanks, Galen. You've called me many things. The first time I've ever heard you call me minister.
So, Minister Flaherty, thanks for joining us in the middle of what is an extremely busy day for you, and you've got to travel to Calgary, as you said, later this afternoon. We regret that you couldn't be here with us in person, as you have said, but we thank you for taking the time, and we thank Bell, our friends at Bell, who are major partners of this conference, for facilitating the video conference with you this morning. Have a great day.
Thank you.
So the next item on the agenda is lunch, and we'll be back in here for the first of the two breakout sessions, the first one on economics and trade and innovation, followed by the one on energy from climate change to clean energy and sustainability, followed by the Premier of Quebec and the Governor of Vermont to wrap it up, followed by a cocktail at the end of the day. Have a good lunch.